What's up? You're listening to Soft Difference, a podcast of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. On this pod, you'll hear from Giorgio, Eric, and myself, Justin, talk about 1 Peter and how 1 Peter calls us to love Jesus and love others in the world. Welcome back, everybody, to Soft Difference Pod. I'm Justin, I'm here with my co-host, Eric.
Yeah, man.
What up, Eric? Today we get to talk some more in depth about 1 Peter and the sermon from Sunday, and I'm grateful to be here with Eric today.
Yeah, dude. Excited to chat. It's a little bit of a gloomy, rainy afternoon here in Winston, but we know it's not gloomy or rainy in your heart, Justin, after 18 innings of Dodger baseball last night.
I'm a little tired and sleepy. Game ended at 3:01 a.m. I was following my clock for the last 2 hours of that game going, oh, I got to get up in the morning. But it was glorious. It was a great game. One of the best World Series history, I think.
Yeah, fandom makes you do dumb things, but it's fun.
Very exciting.
Cool. Were you ready to jump in and chat a little bit about the sermon?
Let's get it.
Yeah, man. So 1 Peter, continuing the series. You stopped last week at verse 6, and this week tackled specifically verse 7. So I was thinking about questions to ask and talk to you about a little bit in the podcast. I think what I would love to hear, maybe others would be interested in hearing, thinking a little bit about process or about the sermon itself, like how do you think like your sermon was different because you preached this one verse by itself than if you had tacked it on last week, which was your original idea, and then in the 8:30 service on the fly last week decided to push it to a separate sermon? Like, what kind of happened like over the last week to your message and to what you were going to say to husbands and to men? Since you did kick it to the next week, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think in general, you know, there was more time dedicated to this particular part of the text. Like, you know, normally you would preach this text, you probably would preach it together.
Sure.
The likewises kind of connect together in a certain way. Right. However, like you don't do servants and masters same likewise.
Yeah.
Like you do that separate.
Yep.
So it's not like precluded from being able to do that. I think that the way the sermon changes is that with the previous text, you're able to like kind of put a tighter narrative arc on just speaking predominantly to the women in the congregation. Mm. Not that if you're a man in there isn't something to learn. There certainly is.
Right.
And in this one, you're able to do the same thing with men, but also just being able to. I mean, I had probably 15 to 20 minutes of a sermon still last week,
right?
On this, and now you can kind of expand it,
and
do a little bit more exegetical work. You can do a little bit more application work. I think what came together for me originally was the empathetic seeing that was going to be a part of the previous sermon, but then I was able to expand the honor parts of that passage to be more stout, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's probably how it changed the most.
Yeah, that's good. Was there anything like in the last 7 days as you chatted with people about verses 1-6 in your sermon on 1-6, like the responses, like dialogue that kind of helped shape this sermon this week? Because again, there's that connection you don't typically have to almost like get 7 days worth of feedback to then like tweak the how you end the sermon almost.
I didn't get a ton of like that. I mean, I got a lot of feedback and there was a lot of discussion about the first section of this, 1-6. I think like it continues to emphasize the importance that we have as husbands and men to see the women in our midst. And so it did give, like, hearing the ladies talk about the first text and give me feedback was helpful that this is the proper direction to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's good, man. It's great. Yeah, I thought it was a great sermon. Took a lot of notes on it. Yeah, I think diving into the passage itself, like there was some really interesting things that you pointed out, like that I think are really important and helpful, like the likewise, which you already mentioned, like when we just started talking already in the first couple of minutes here, but that likewise and like connecting husband's life and this command to husbands to the previous sections, that there's this pattern of humility, you use the phrase again of like cruciform life, that is flowing through here is like super important to make sure we don't like miss that connecting word. Like it carries a lot of weight.
It does. Yeah, for sure.
So I thought that was really great. Love that. I think one of the interest, maybe, yeah, two other kind of phrases that I thought were really big in this passage was like how you explained the phrase weaker vessel, which is one of those phrases that when you read this passage that makes it feel like a scary passage to say like, don't love that language. Like that's pretty tough. Like how do we deal with that? And you kind of explained how it's not about like ontological value or like one's worth, but it's actually about like a Greco Roman woman's feeling of vulnerability. Like when they lived in a culture where they had no power, no legal status, no rights, that they would have felt weaker, their experience would have been weaker in that way. I don't know if you want to double click on that anymore, but I thought that was really powerful and really important.
Yeah, so I think I do think this it wouldn't be like off to say that in Peter's context to be able to say that strength wise, like in general, like women may have like be weaker in the sense of strength, physical strength, like, and I alluded to that a little bit in the passage, just in helping empathetic seeing
what. Yeah.
You know, we as men can't walk around in our wives' bodies and feel the things that they feel
right.
when they're in a space with men.
Right, that's right. How that, I remember you mentioned that.
How that feels for them in a space, especially if they're alone, and the physical strength aspect is there. So I don't think he may have been saying that in part. Of course, but, you know, we could just talk, you know, Chris and I were talking about this a little bit, like, you know, typically, you know, women give birth to babies and experience an intense amount of pain, and they're incredibly strong,
right,
like physically strong to go through that and to endure that.
Yeah,
you know, there's statistics to say, like, you know, men's pain tolerance is less than a woman's,
right,
and they have to be given actually more pain drugs than a woman does typically in a hospital setting. I don't know if Brian could back that up or not. But like, so there, I had problems with like just equating that to physical strength because of some of those like variables.
Sure, sure.
But I wouldn't say that Peter didn't necessarily see that in his context. But I certainly was confident that like culturally, like, and even the way Peter, like he starts with women principally because they occupy a lower status in the Greco-Roman world. And I felt like that made the most sense in what Peter's calling men to do when he mentions the word weaker vessel. Now, Katie Benoit and I talked about this a little bit, and she also brought up, like, you know, a porcelain, so to create something that's porcelain,
right?
That you might display
and
give honor to in your house, like, you know, whether it's a plate or a dish or a bowl or whatever, like, that has to undergo a significant amount of heat to create, almost as much as what steel and metal has to go through on a, you know, heat variable. Mm. And she said, like her seminary professors pointed this out to her, is that there is, and if Peter's talking to people who are persecuted, like the heat has been turned up in their lives.
Right.
Like, and like, a weaker vessel, a woman is a weaker vessel, that has to be considered, like, they are the heat variable that they go through is just as strong, if you use that analogy, as men.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But there might be, like, it might be more delicate to be handled in the sense of, like, because of their status, we have to have pay particular attention to that, especially in Peter's world.
Yeah.
So I felt like that was, you know, pretty strong. A lot of commentators kind of took that angle as far as like, this is, it's really talking about place of status and honor that women have. And if you think about the laws, just the way things worked, you know, as far as an inheritance and legal status, like women didn't have that.
Right.
And so Peter here is again, like calling men to be aware of that and to like work to flip that in some ways.
Yeah. 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 No, that's good. Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. Jumping into the sermon itself, you had 2 points, a call to frightening empathy and a call to frightening reversal, which I thought was really great, sticking on that frightening theme, coming from the previous sermon. And yeah, under the empathy one, you referenced Brené Brown and this idea of empathy versus sympathy. And you talked about the illustration of a person in a pit, which I thought was really great and really helpful that you gotta get down into the pit and not just stay up on the outer rim hollering down at the person. I'm so sorry. Which I thought was a really great illustration. I'm sure I probably heard her say that before, maybe in some TED talk or something. I just forgot about it. But I think it's a really, really great illustration, but talking about empathy versus sympathy and then how Jesus provides the template for that, that in his incarnation, he descends and that the call for us as men is to likewise go through some small descent in order to empathize. I don't know if you want to say more about that, but I thought that was a really, really great point.
Yeah, I think I didn't tease this out necessarily in the sermon, but the frightening parts of that for us, whether it's just human-to-human relationships or husbands to wives, is like the time that it takes to practice empathy is real. Like, it is so much easier to stay outside someone's story and situation and just say, man, that stinks that you're going through that. And to be sympathetic to their situation versus like actually trying to reverse it. Like,
yeah,
that is a different work. And empathy does have this piece that we are called to identify, to sit with, like, to understand, right? Peter uses that language, to understand. Mm-hmm. That's one work. And I think this is why these things go so well together, is that then the reversal piece of actually engaging with the things, not to fix, which I was like, I think one of my personal struggles, I remember one of the guys in my pastor's group, he talked about his relationship with his wife at one of our annual meetings, retreats.
Yeah.
And he just made this like notion, like, I feel like I'm just managing my wife and I'm not really loving her. And I mean, that really stuck with me. Like how much do we manage our spouses? And by manage, I mean, like, we don't want ire. So we do the things that we do, not from a place of love, but because we don't want pushback or, you know, the side eye, we just do it because we're managing it instead of like actually loving. So we come home from work, and if your wife stays home and she's been with the kids, or even if she works and she's picked up the kids earlier than you and you come home, like, you take those kids out of a way of managing, not out of a place of love. And I think that's a real temptation for us as men to both fix and manage. Like, you know, Danette and I, she told me about a situation that she was having this last week, and like, I did not empathize with her initially. I tried to fix it.
Yeah.
Right. And she was like, that was a conversation we talked. We had our weekly meeting where we kind of review our week and talk about the week ahead. And that was something that she brought up. She goes, that was a miss. Like, you showed up in a way that was really about fixing, not about entering in and empathizing.
Yeah.
This is the tension point, right? Like,
yeah.
The reversal, yes. Like, there is a sense of like, we are reversing, we are called to reverse, to give honor to our wives in places where they are not being given honor, and a way to reverse status. But it's not necessarily fixing. And fixing comes from, I think, a different heart standpoint where we're not actually lifting them up as co-heirs. We're actually getting a lot of synergy and life from being the fix-it guys. And we're not really about honoring them. We're about achieving honor for ourselves, which I didn't, again, I could have teased a lot of this out in the sermon.
Yeah,
it probably would have been helpful. But we're about getting honor for ourselves, and that's why we fix, and that's why we manage. It's not from this place of love where we're actually trying to give our wives the same honor that we are after, and more so, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's really good, really helpful. Yeah, and so, yeah, to give them honor, we have to, yeah, follow that cruciform life of descending and lowering ourselves down.
Right, and Jesus' example, like the Philippians 2 passage, which was actually referenced in our Confession of Sin this week, which I thought was great.
Nice, yeah.
Becky did a great job with that. Like, there is this kenosis, this emptying of Jesus that he does so that we can be brought up. Like, yes, Jesus gets the name above every other name in that passage because he emptied himself.
Yeah.
And the implication of the cruciform life is as we empty ourselves, we also are given honor, like with Jesus. Like, Jesus achieves honor for us because we're in union with him. We receive that honor as if we ourselves emptied ourselves, but that then becomes the pattern of our Christian life and existence.
Yeah.
Like, as husbands, fathers, people who work in the workplace, maybe, like, we should be people who are emptying ourselves to give others honor and status.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Anytime I hear somebody reference the Philippians 2 passage, I'm reminded of a story. One of the pastors from the Liberty Network in Philly, he would tell this great story about how he was stuck in like a McDonald's play place kind of type deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And he like couldn't find his way out of it
before COVID when they had these places.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if it was actually a McDonald's or somewhere else, but he was like stuck in one of these like kids play places and couldn't find his way out. And like this, and this kid comes like crawling by and he's just like, kid, like, how do I get out of here? And he says, I can see where I need to go up there. How do I get out of here? And the kid says, oh, to go up, you actually have to go down.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
And the pastor was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
He like couldn't find his way out of this like kid's play place. And I'll just never forget the image that is in my mind of this guy attempting to crawl through these like tunnel of mazes.
Yeah.
Ask this like 8-year-old how to get out of there. That's so good, man. Under frightening reversal, two, you talked about like keeping score, and how like a ledger marriage kills love, and you talked a lot about expectations, which I thought was really, really good, and how we need to accept the real and not the ideal version of our wives. And expectations, like, it's such a huge, I think it's such a huge thing. It's one of the things that Carrie and I talk about when we do premarital counseling. It's like one of the big things we harp on is that, you know, when unmet expectations cause a ton of conflict in a marriage or in any relationship, but in a marriage especially. And one of the things that we'll say is, hey, if those expectations are uncommunicated, like, you're setting your spouse up to fail. But going to the sermon itself, the other piece of it is if those expectations are unrealistic, then you're also setting yourself up to fail. And so it's important to like repent of those and to bring the real rather than the ideal. So I thought that was really great.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I read Tripp's book, I'd been married a long time, but you know, Tripp talks in his book on expectations. In marriage, he says that, you know, when your spouse is meeting your expectations, obviously they're easy to love. Like he says, like, love begins the moment your spouse doesn't meet your expectations. Like, that's actually when you show and display love. And so in the sermon, I talked about perpetual absolution, which in the sense of just like living a life of forgiveness for one another, especially as husbands for our wives, in the places of these unmet expectations, because they're going to exist. And some of them will be uncommunicated.
Yep.
Like, totally. Depending on your kind of wiring and story.
Yep.
It may really be really hard to share your expectations. There might be a lot of fear surrounding sharing those things.
Yeah,
and so it's very difficult to not have your expectations always met in marriage, and to respond to that not with you know, bitterness and frustration and sadness and anger, but to instead, you know, respond with like love and like a press in instead of a push away.
Right.
So much easier to withdraw. And yet, like, this passage is just littered with like, how do we like stay connected? Empathy is largely that. It is a, it's a connective way of being human to another person, and push towards and not away. And that's what perpetual absolution is. It's like having a life of a posture of forgiveness towards unmet expectations and pushing towards instead of away.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have a signed copy of Tripp's What to Expect When You're Expecting in my office. I pre-ordered it when I was in college. I was engaged to Carrie, I think, or we were dating. But that is one of my favorite marriage books. In introductory chapter, you're a sinner married to a sinner living in a fallen world. It's like, oh yeah, it's a good point. And he talks in there too, if I remember right. It's been a long time since I've read the book, but one of the practices that he talks about is confession and forgiveness. Like that is one of the key practices for a marriage. And so, yeah, you definitely talked about that.
Like if this when your child does something wrong, even if you're not like a parent that's kind of been hard on your child and have lots of disciplinary rules or whatever, like your child does something that's wrong and they immediately feel a sense of shame, right? And so as a parent, we can either like double down on that shame or we can somehow reverse that shame. The gospel like calls us to be like reversers of shame, like to give honor and instead of shame. And I think in marriage, it's the same kind of thing.
Like, yeah, it's good.
If our spouse fails us, the temptation, and I feel this every time, like if I make a mistake driving the car and I hit, like Danette has a very particular way about the wheels on her car. Like, don't scratch those wheels.
She's got some rims, dog.
Yeah, bro. And I've scratched up many a wheel because I'm just not always as careful driving the car. And that feeling of sense when she corrects that reality,
yeah,
is like it's a moment of shame, right? And in marriages, that's what we can do. Like, we can just bring out. And I'm not necessarily dogging on Danette in that. I'm just saying, like, in marriages, that's what we can do. It's like we can just add shame when somebody does something against us or doesn't meet our expectation, and that is not honoring. Like, honoring is bringing them out from that shame and placing them in a place of honor instead of shame, even when they failed you.
Yeah.
And that's very hard to do. And it's a scary thing to do. It's so much easier to hang out in a place where you did that. You always do that. Like, that's just much easier.
Yeah, that's true. What is it about the car, man? Like, there's something about cars. Like, I think Carrie and me, I think some of our worst fights have happened while driving.
Yeah.
Like, cars are awful. One of the other thoughts that I had, too, about the expectations thing is that, we need to repent of our expectations. But then there's also the idea of, like, bringing our expectations into reality a little bit. Like, almost like lowering our expectations, if that makes sense. And I think that was part of the sermon as I was kind of dwelling on that a little bit that I thought was really fascinating. Cause I think some of my frustrations, like personally, like I can have with Carrie or whatever, when she's not meeting my expectations, it's really not anything that she's doing. Like she's not doing anything wrong. She's not crossing any boundaries. She doesn't need to ask me for forgiveness. Like, I'm just mad because of my own expectations that are just dumb. Not even like idealized, just sort of stupid. And I just need to like lower those or like change those, or like tweak those. So I don't know if you didn't really talk about that necessarily. I think the repent of your expectations gets to that a little bit, but I'd be curious, like, what are your thoughts around just like how we deal with our own expectations of our spouses? Like, how do we need to like adjust those, tweak those, bring those down?
Gottman says the four horsemen that are the deadly horsemen of a marriage are stonewalling, disgust, defensiveness, and criticism, critical spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think you could relate expectations to all four of those.
For sure.
But I think particularly in the place of being critical,
yeah.
Like, I know for myself, like my struggle when I'm under stress as an Enneagram 7, I become a 1 and I get super critical of the people in my life. So like that is like lowering our expectations is an attempt to not be so critical.
Yeah.
And empathy is that place, right? Like,
yeah.
Again, your spouse, if you're listening to this, comes into this with their own story and their own things that have brought them to all these years that they've lived to where you sit right now.
Yeah.
And like that impacts like how they're able to engage with certain expectations or not.
Yeah.
And the more critical I am of, you know, Danette or anyone else, like the more my expectations amp up.
Yeah.
And I start to like get in my own head and spiral over all the ways my needs aren't being met. And that leads to disgust.
Right. Right.
And for her, it could lead to defensiveness and stonewalling, which are the thing, all these things like play against each other. And they make marriage hard. And if in Peter's kind of purview, like again, like if understanding your wife is like their status in the world and what they have to like walk through and live with, even in our modern day world, and to be people who give honor, that does cut across the grain of a critical spirit with high expectations. Yeah. So I think it is a tension point. Like you said, like expectations do need to be somewhat communicated.
Yeah.
And they have to be altered and lowered.
Right.
Like,
altered's a good word.
Into reality. Like,
yep.
Your human being spouse can only do certain things. Like, they can't meet your needs like God can. Like,
that's right.
Like, that is part of, like, when we have unmet longings, you know, as Christians, it is a place where God is supposed to be where we slough off onto him. And I'm gonna have unmet longings in this life.
That's right.
Like,
yep.
How do I live with that, God? Not just go take it for myself and get what I want.
Yeah. No, that's really good. yeah, and I was thinking too, like even as you were talking, I think that I'll try to like bring this through the angle of parenting. It's which is like something that as one who has a first grader and a 4-year-old, like it's sort of, it dominates a lot of carries in my conversation.
Yeah.
And you know, I think like when one of my daughters is crying and maybe I've been critical of her in some form or fashion and she's crying because she, you know, I've gotten upset or she's just failing to pick up the toys or whatever. I mean, whatever, you know, we always get mad at the dumbest things. Right. In hindsight. That like the options there are to like double down and be critical and like get big. Or it's to like lower yourself, like get down on their level, like look them in the eyes, like sit on the floor with them and just try to say like, hey, like what's going on? Like, you know, like why are you so upset about this? I had a counselor friend of mine say that like when a child is crying like that, it's they're advocating for themselves because they just don't know how else to do it. And so it's they're just trying to like express something they don't have the words for. And by getting down on their level and empathizing, so I'll try to bring this around, and empathizing with them, it typically makes the whole situation go better.
For sure.
than just trying to like from the stairway just continue to like dominate over and lord over and get loud and get, you know.
And again, what's scary about that is, and you know this if you have kids, is like wherever you're sitting means you have to get up.
Yeah,
it's so much easier to stand up at the top floor and yell down, pick up your toys.
Yeah.
Why aren't you picking up your toys? Why are you crying?
Yeah.
Instead of like actually walking down the stairs.
Right.
And then the part of empathy that's like really powerful in that is like as they share what they're feeling, if they're able to, you're able to then go, oh, yeah, I know what that felt like.
Right.
I was a kid too.
Yeah.
I know exactly how that felt. And almost every time I did that as a parent, especially with my oldest, with Jed, like it just would always go better when I'd enter into it with my own story that was like his story.
Yeah. And that's a way that we honor them, yep. right? Is that you get down on their level, you treat them like human beings yep. that are equal in value and worth. And so I guess I wanted to circle back around as well. That like you gave these two practices as like your kind of application at the end, which you talked about and kind of wove through your two main points. But the practice of perpetual forgiveness, the practice of empathetic seeing, and it's through doing these two things that we actually give honor. Mm-hmm. To our wives, to our spouses.
Yeah, that's good. I didn't make that connection as explicit probably as I could have, but that's true.
Yeah, that's just kind of what's circulated in my head, yep. But yep. I think that's really great. Those are a lot of the notes that I wrote down. So I'm just sort of asking you questions about all the stuff that I wrote down that I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
are there other things that like you wanted to double click on, or any like leftovers, anything you left on the cutting room floor you didn't have space for, you wished you did?
Yeah. So before I talk about leftovers, I would like to say, like in the empathetic seeing piece, like I do think there is a lot for us to till, Redeemer, like in our moment of like right now, what does it feel like to be a woman in our world? In conservative evangelical churches and reformed Presbyterian churches, like what does it feel like for women in our midst, and how can we honor the women in our midst? I think that starts in your home, understanding like the things that our women do on a day-to-day basis, the way that they move in our world and are animated, yeah. the things that animate them and the things that are trying to animate them that, they themselves know aren't good for them yeah. to be animated by, like to understand that and to see the struggle, like especially like I talked in the sermon about beauty and allurement, which Peter addresses directly in the text before,
right?
And the pressures that brings upon them to understand that and to be empathetic is a work. Not like in a work, like a hard, arduous work. It's just a work of presence and being able to like understand. And we have our own things too, sometimes as
right.
men. And,
right.
Especially if, we have lots of, women in our church who have young kids and work.
Right.
And the process right. of both of those things, like,
yeah.
how can I see you and honor you in the things that you're doing? It's a really powerful thing for a marriage when you feel seen by your spouse.
Yeah.
And it is an honoring thing. So how can we do that? And so I would press into that for you is like, that would be a place, that's a place that I need to be like continually working out my salvation.
Yeah.
And it might be for you too. On the things that I left out, like I had in my original manuscript, I really wanted to talk a little bit about like our current moment things like toxic empathy and toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
And I had a whole section on this. Actually, my friend Josh Burdett is a counselor in Tulsa. He just went to, he was in a group of churches that I got to know him through. And Josh actually had an article that came out on toxic masculinity. Mm. I really wanted to kind of draw some of the insights that he had into that, but I just didn't have the space, so I had to leave that out. Yeah. But I was, we have a young men in our church, and women, like where TikTok and influencers have become like speaking to what it means to be male and female
and
in our world. And there are people out there like Andrew Tate.
Right.
And others like him and Christian versions of that
are
speaking into this moment where young men are searching for an identity and they're speaking more to a more patriarchal, dominant like way of being a man.
Right.
And it's animating a lot of young men like in our churches and in our world. So I really wanted to like kind of engage with that. And the toxic empathy piece comes with that because I think from that same kind of vein of like, this version of masculinity comes the accusation that empathy can be a sin.
Yeah.
And that's also in our reformed like world.
Right.
PCA churches talking about empathy as being toxic. And certainly when we speak of empathy, it is not like just to, like it is an under level of understanding. It's entering into somebody else's humanity. It's being there to be someone who honors them in their story and helps by honor to reverse the status that they might feel. Yes. But it's not without, like, we just empathize with you and we just say you can just be like this forever. Like that's not it either. Calling empathy toxic has like severe implications.
Yeah.
And, I think what we and a lot of young folks end up hearing in this is that to empathize is a sin. And
yeah.
I think the Bible is like very clear that empathy is a practice of
for sure
Jesus and a practice of our faith. So I wanted to talk about that, but didn't have space.
Yeah, no, that's really good, man. There's a ton there with all that kind of stuff. I think that is good too, even just here on the podcast to kind of bring that in, and even to talk about the church as a community,
yeah,
and how we do this. You know, one of the things that's difficult about passages like this and now preaching back-to-back weeks on what's predominantly geared towards wives and husbands is that we have a chunk of our congregation that is neither of those things right now, either because they're 12 and sitting in the service, or because they're in their 20s or 30s and they just aren't in that place in their lives, or or people that are divorced. And so it's like, well, how does this apply to them?
Yeah.
How do we try to live into these things? How do we honor women, even if you're not a husband? Mm-hmm. You know, what does that look like as a call for a man in their workplaces or in their friend groups or in their church community? I really like these practices that you mentioned, and then even the things that you're talking about. Like, there's application here for mm-hmm. any male that's mm-hmm. sitting in our congregation, yep. not just for husbands.
Yep.
Yeah.
And a call for the church to be that community that tries to like live this out and model it for those.
Yeah.
Like, if the call is what Jesus talks about Peter talks about in the end of chapter 2, like the pattern and way of Jesus, like if that is how we are to be embodied in the world, mm-hmm. like we are not Jesus, we're going to fail, like, and we're going to rest in what Jesus has done for us in our failures. But the cruciform life is still the call for us as Christians. And if you're 12 or 18 and you're male or female, like this is a call to this kind of life. It's a call to humility.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's a call to elevating the status of those around you, not just your own.
Yeah.
And like, no matter what the relationship is,
yeah,
right? Whether it's a platonic friendship or it's a marriage or it's just like a father and son, like, how can we be a people who are showing honor and elevating the status of those around us? That is the ethic that Peter's calling the church to.
Yeah, no, that's really good.
And it has missional implications, right? Like,
yeah,
this is how people will know who we follow and that it's true.
Yeah.
Like that's like, George is going to get more into that next week, but that kicked this whole thing off. Like, let your conduct be pure among the Gentiles.
That's right.
So that they might see like, this is how we live.
Yeah. It starts at home. Right. Mm-hmm. And Peter is speaking to households. He's speaking to husbands and wives. But it's a lot bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And you even said at one point in the sermon, it's not about domestic management, like mm-hmm. in and of itself, that it starts there. But there's a call to discipleship that I think ultimately has like a missional telos that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good word. And
it's what makes this passage so rich. I mean, this is what Jeff talked about. If you listen to that podcast, he talked about like just the beauty of this letter is that like that. The ethics always have this missional impulse, and that it is like if our homes could like somehow just be modeled by this way of being, it permeates out into the world in some ways and provides a level of witness to Jesus. Whether people believe it or not, it still provides a witness to Jesus about his way, which is going down.
Yeah. Yeah,
like the guy in the playground.
To go up,
you gotta go down, man. If you want to get out of here,
Barry Knoll, if you're listening, we love you, buddy. No questions from the congregation this week. All of our men are doing fine at this, and so none of them asked any questions. But
they're killing it out there.
But yeah, I think we're good for today.
If you're so, let me ask you a question.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Like, how would this look for you, Eric, to live with Carrie in an understanding way? What would it look like for you to lose honor for her sake? Put you on blast here.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think it's such a good question, obviously. It's been so interesting to sit with the honor thing over these last few weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And to think about that as like a limited resource, like a commodity that if you give it away, you lose. Mm-hmm. I think even like I wrote down, like as you were talking a few minutes ago, I think something that clicked for me, like the idea of fixing and managing, I think is certainly an impulse for me, which I think is true for a lot of guys. But certainly is an impulse for me and my personality that, I am quick to jump in to want to fix or want to manage Carrie or our household, or some problem or situation. I don't know if I even think about it as trying to gain honor for myself by doing that, but that's something I'm going to sit in and think about. I think one of the ways to honor for me to live in honoring Carrie, is this idea of, like coming, and I don't yell at Carrie from the stairwell, but to go back to the kid metaphor, like is to like get up off the couch or like walk all the way down the stairs and just like to sit on the proverbial floor with her, mm-hmm. and just try to say like, hey, like, you know, what's really going on here? Like, what mm-hmm. are you really like thinking and feeling? Mm-hmm. Rather than just trying to say, oh, well, Monday night, you know, well, maybe if we do this, you know, babe, you don't have to go. And like, we could fix it this around, move this around. Like I could take your car and we could, you know, and like, you just get into all that stuff. But I think it would probably just be slowing down and like taking a breath and not jumping into fix it mode.
Yeah. That's good.
I think that's kind of what has struck me the most here. I think Carrie and I have a pretty good pattern of like confession and forgiveness with each other. Not that that's perfect. And we've gone to counseling to help learn some of that like in years past. But I think that idea of empathizing rather than fixing is something I want to sit in. I think that's a big one for me.
Yeah. I think it's really easy to get in a pattern of logistics, like with your spouse. Like,
yeah.
We're just managing logistics. Like you manage your car and when it needs an oil change and all that.
Yeah.
You manage your bank account. Like those are things that you manage. And maybe in a sense that could, you go, well, I'm honoring my car by managing like its oil changes, right? Whatever. But I think at the end of the day, like, I think those are things are meant to be managed. People are not. Mm. Like, people are meant to be entered into with presence.
Yeah.
And, you know, self-giving.
Yeah.
Like love.
Yeah.
And so how can I be self-giving in this moment to my wife? And most of the time that's listening, being curious.
Yeah.
And asking questions, not making assumptions.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
And then trying to elevate her voice.
Mm-hmm.
Like I used to rescue all the conflicts in the house, right? As an attempt to manage. And what I did was stole some of her voice and her agency when I would do that.
Yeah.
And certainly she might have been frustrated. And certainly there was times when she definitely needed my help to do that, right? But many times it became more about like I come in and rescue and bring peace and la la or whatever.
Right.
And ended up kind of making her voice more hushed. And that's not fair to her. That's not honoring to her. Mm. So.
Yeah,
I think it's a really good one. Like, I think it's one I struggle with, and I think most men can struggle with, and women for that matter, in some ways.
Sure,
like we are good at managing each other.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good, man. So thanks everyone for tuning in to the Soft Difference podcast. Go back and listen to the sermon if you missed it, or listen to it again. Over these next couple of weeks, as we continue to move through this series, you know, if you're here on Sundays with us in the bulletin, there's the QR code right there that you can scan to send in questions. Feel free just to shoot us emails too. That's always fine. And we'd love to talk and have dialogue on this podcast. with your questions. So please send those in. That sharpens our thoughts and sharpens our conversation. And we'd love to hear what you're thinking. So please do that. And until next time, we'll see you later.
Adios.